welcome to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 41, and today I'm joined by Francisco Gonzalez, professor of philosophy at the University of Ottawa. Frank's work centers on ancient philosophy, contemporary hermeneutics, and the relation between metaphysics and ethics and politics. His first book, Dialectic and Dialogue, Plato's Practice of Philosophical Inquiry from Northwestern University Press in 1998, offers insight into dialogue as a philosophical practice. This book has been of enormous help to me as I consider the nature of Platonic politics as rooted in the writing of dialogues. In his most recent book, A Question of Dialogue, Plato and Heidegger, from Penn State Press in 2009, engages Heidegger's reading of Plato and argues that Heidegger never really entered into a philosophically fruitful dialogue with Plato. Today, however, Frank is here to discuss the paper he gave this morning at the Ancient Philosophy Society gathering at the 2010 meeting of the Society for Phenomenology and Existentialist Philosophy here in Montreal, Canada. That paper is entitled What's in a Moment? Time for Aristotle and Heidegger, and it takes up Heidegger's engagement with Aristotle's notion of kinesis, or motion, in a number of unpublished lectures from the 1920s, in order to argue that Heidegger privileges kinesis in a way that eclipses the philosophical power of Aristotle's own understanding of energeia, or activity, being at work. The paper was very well received this morning, and I'm really happy to have Frank here with me to talk in more detail about his essay and to join me on the Digital Dialogue. So welcome to the Digital Dialogue, Frank.
It's a pleasure to join you.
It's great to be here in Montreal. Let's start by talking. I'm really just interested, first of all, in some of the research that went into the lectures, the Heidegger lectures, unpublished Heidegger lectures. Yes. You said you did that at Stanford?
I did at Stanford this August. Mm-hmm. I spent a week or a bit more there, going through the transcripts that were available there, because it's quite a substantial collection of transcripts by in the hand of Helen Weiss, mm-hmm. herself, one of Heidegger's students at the time, but also other students clearly took part in these transcripts because you get different writing styles in the same transcript.
So those are transcripts taken sort of freehand by students rather than, you know, the official transcripts that Heidegger himself
produced. Exactly. Okay. But they seem to vary somewhat in terms of their polish and their thoroughness, but most of them seem fairly thorough. Mm-hmm. Some of the courses, for example, the course on medieval ontology from 24-25 that I mentioned, mm-hmm. The transcript is very coherent, mm-hmm. very well structured, mm-hmm. very polished, and these aren't lecture courses, they're seminars, and so it would be a smaller group of advanced students, and I assume that some of them were more open-ended in terms of the format of the seminar as opposed to a lecture course. Mm-hmm. But it's also clear that in all of these seminars, Heidegger did lecture, that he had a particular interpretation of Aristotle and of the Aristotelian text that he wanted to convey. And so the Heideggerian voice comes through quite clearly in the transcript.
So you mentioned this lecture on medieval philosophy, 24-25,
is it? Yes.
Yeah. And which, of course, was all about Aristotle. I like how Heidegger mm-hmm. will announce a lecture on, let's say, the Sophists, yes. and spend the first semester part of the semester on Aristotle.
So, and that's with justification, because he does the transition in the seminar is that we can fully comprehend what's going on in medieval ontology only if we understand Aristotle, and so that's the excuse for entering this very extensive reading of Aristotle. But it's a fascinating text because he deals there with a number of texts he doesn't deal with anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And it's also the one seminar I found that really is where it really is like is a lecture. It's very clear, it's very well structured, mm-hmm. it's a very there's a clear thesis, there's an argument that runs true from beginning to end.
So I just want to say, ask a couple of quick questions about these manuscripts, and then we'll go mm-hmm. in, because I actually am interested in the topic of this medieval lecture, which was, or at least where Heidegger himself addresses the central passage that you focus on in your essay in Metaphysics Theta about the difference between mm-hmm. kinesis and energeia. So we'll get to that. Yes. But are these documents typed up, or are they in hand?
They're handwritten.
So that's the challenge.
Yeah, that is the challenge. And again, there's a lot of variation there. As I said, there are different handwriting styles.
Right.
But it's it can be quite a challenge.
Yeah.
And what's particularly frustrating is that at this point I can go through and I can read most of it, but then there'll be one word that I just can't make out at all. And of course, it's usually a crucial
right,
word.
Of course, right.
The essence of the soul is.
Right.
What is that word?
Is that? Right.
So
the author got carried away with whatever Heidegger was saying and probably wrote it in a hurried way. Yeah.
And some of them, for the one course I referred to just briefly this morning, it's the earliest of them. It's a 1921 course on De Anima,
mm-hmm.
a reading of De Anima, which is of a great interest to me
yeah.
because one doesn't really find in Heidegger's work too much discussion of Aristotle's, of that text,
right.
of Aristotle's De Anima.
Right.
But that is one text which not only is handwritten, but it's actually in pencil,
mm-hmm.
and the pencil's already fading.
Oh boy!
And it's unwritten on both sides, very thin paper.
Oh no!
And so the one side is bleeding through the other.
Oh.
So it's nearly impossible.
So were you able to make some copies of these things, or are you?
Well, that one, for example, I couldn't copy
uh-huh.
just because of the state of the writing. It
right.
would just, if you copied it, the writing from the other side of the page would just come through
and
just become utterly unreadable.
Yeah.
So that one I'm actually going to have to go back next summer
to
spend more time working
right.
with the manuscript itself. The other ones I could copy
uh-huh.
and fairly easily.
So one of the things that interests me, and as you mentioned, about this time in Heidegger's life is
mm-hmm.
that he's really involved with a very substantive and long-lasting, for a decade-long at least, engagement with Aristotle
mm-hmm.
that led up to the publication of Being in Time.
Yes.
And, you know, there are all kinds of things in these lectures that are the ones that I've read that are published, but the ones now that you're talking about that are unpublished,
mm-hmm.
where you see anticipations of certain central elements of Being in Time and see him working through clearly in this essay that you gave
mm-hmm.
today the question of time, the question of temporality. So maybe we could talk a little bit about Heidegger's approach to kinesis in these essays, in these lectures that you looked at.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just note too that the one seminar that I primarily focused on is from 1928, which
mm-hmm.
means that it's even after the publication of Being in Time,
right.
he was still coming back to Aristotle
and
still confronting the issue of motion
right.
in Aristotle, kinesis in Aristotle,
right.
and its relation to time.
Right. And that was the, because I, that 1928 was when he started in Freiburg, when he took over the Lehrstuhl from Husserl. And because the reason why I was thinking about that recently is because I was reading some notes that a student, I think his name is Bryce Gibson, wrote when he was there in Freiburg in 1928 about, you know, just being in that.
Mm-hmm.
He was studying abroad. He was a United States student, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And and one of the things he said, going to the issue of the De Anima, is that it seemed to have been suggested at the time that whether Heidegger said it or in a lecture or not,
mm-hmm.
that the De Anima is really phenomenological without the reduction, and that this was
mm-hmm.
this was Aristotle being a phenomenologist. And so that's
mm-hmm.
something that was very important to me in my book
yes.
on Aristotle and Truth, because I'm trying to read
mm-hmm.
Aristotle really as a phenomenologist,
right.
phenomenologist of life.
Mm-hmm.
So what about kinesis here in the 1928 lecture?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned in the paper, the key assertion of that seminar, which Heidegger presents at several points in the seminars as his Behauptung, so he comes right out and says, this is what I'm maintaining,
right.
is that for Aristotle, and here I think he recognizes he's going beyond Aristotle, but at least he believes that there's a basis in Aristotle for this view, that the being of understanding itself
mm-hmm.
is motion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he calls the absolute motion, or Urbewegung, the original motion. Mm-hmm. It's the movement of ontological inquiry itself. Mm-hmm. And it's because ontological inquiry itself has the character of kinesis, or motion, mm-hmm. that then it's possible to understand things that are moved, or things that are unmoved,
right.
or even things that are incapable of motion. So there's this idea that at the basis of ontological understanding itself is motion.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's, again, this step back and saying, what is the nature of our own being when
right.
we are doing ontology?
Right.
And if we recognize that the nature of our own being when we're doing ontology is motion,
right.
that then becomes the ground from which, or on which, we can understand things as in the world
right.
as moved.
Right.
So it's generally an attempt to, and here he sees himself as going against the tradition in both medieval ontology, but also in Greek ontology, to understand motion primarily in terms of the motion of things in the world,
mm-hmm.
right? And to instead recognize that our understanding of the motion of things in the world
mm-hmm.
is derived from the fact that understanding itself is motion.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so the primary motion here is the motion that characterizes our very understanding.
Right.
And it's that motion that provides the ground or the basis for recognizing motion in anything else.
Right. So I mean, this is what's always perplexed me. I mean, it was great to hear you today because I've always been perplexed by Heidegger's decision to emphasize kinesis as opposed to, as you argue, energeia,
mm-hmm.
particularly when, and as I've argued in Ethics of Ontology, and you, I know, commented extensively on that text, and I appreciate that, by the way, and you know, about the difference between energeia as a complete, a kind of mm-hmm. complete motion that has its end in itself, that is at every moment whole in a robust sense, and kinesis as an incomplete motion, something that is once it's reached its telos, it ends, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of building and constructing a house isn't it kind of an example of that, right? So that
mm-hmm.
in Metaphysics 9, chapter 6 and through 8, you know, Aristotle really makes this distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Heidegger goes back to kinesis, after reading that chapter, those chapters of Aristotle, you're thinking, well, what kind of kinesis could this be? And I thought you did a nice job
mm-hmm.
of sort of trying to talk about absolute kinesis on Heidegger's terms.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So can you just talk a little bit about Heidegger's understanding of absolute kinesis there?
Well, I think it has to be understood in the context of his destructive
mm-hmm.
project. That
mm-hmm.
is, that what he's doing is he claims that the, as he says in a number of points in these seminars, particularly in the seminar on medieval ontology,
uh-huh.
that the Greeks and therefore the whole tradition that the Greeks led to, took their conception of being, of what it means to be, from the world, from things encountered within the world, from
mm-hmm.
our experience of things within the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the conception of being that gives you is a conception of being as Vorhandenheit and
mm-hmm.
Anwesenheit. A conception of being is what's present at hand, or a conception
right.
of being generally as presence.
Right.
And then the problem then becomes that conception of being as presence, when it's then applied to our own being, to an attempt to understand our own being,
mm-hmm.
Creates all kinds of problems, because we're not at hand.
Right.
Present at hand objects,
mm-hmm.
right? As Heidegger emphasizes, of course, in Being and Time
yeah.
and everywhere else.
Right.
So the problem he sees in the philosophical tradition is that the conception of being that is derived from our experience of things within the world, when it's then applied to our own being, or even to the being of God, of the divine,
mm-hmm.
in medieval ontology, proves inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he's doing is he's trying to go back, and going back to Aristotle, he's trying, on the one hand, to see how that conception of being as presence emerges in Aristotle.
Right.
But he's also looking in Aristotle for something that is in tension with or counteracts that conception of being.
Mm-hmm.
And what is in tension with or counteracts the conception of being is kinesis, is motion, mm-hmm. and Aristotle's awareness of an attempt to do justice to the phenomenon of motion.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what Heidegger is doing, and going back to Aristotle, is he's radicalizing the notion of motion in Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas he still believes that in the end, Aristotle ends up understanding motion in terms of presence, because that's still the operative conception of being for Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
Heidegger's trying to destroy that conception of being as presence, to sort of dismantle it, undermine it, by emphasizing Aristotle's own awareness of the phenomenon of kinesis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's, you know, that's the project.
Right.
So that's the strategy.
Mm-hmm.
It's to oppose to the traditional conception of being as presence, a conception of being that is what he refers to in one course as and he speaks of this as his, in fact, as his goal, or what he's trying to formulate or establish, a pandynamique des Seins, he calls it.
Mm-hmm.
So a pandunamis, a being, a conception of being as just dunamis, conception of a completely dynamic conception
mm-hmm.
of being.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's seeking against the identification of being with presence and vorhandenheit
mm-hmm.
in the tradition. So I think that's the project. It's this attempt. So for him, motion is the way, and privileging motion and talking about our own existence as this absolute motion.
Right.
That's not any sort of, not any kind of being present or being at hand, but is this radical, open-ended, finite
mm-hmm.
motion, the only telos of which is death.
Right.
It's by emphasizing that he is countering this reduction of being to presence. And that he's therefore also countering the reduction of time to presence, and trying to uncover a more radical temporality that would privilege the future and privilege this open-ended being underway that he sees human existence to be.
So does it, so that's helpful, because it would explain part of my next question, which is why not energe, why not look to energe for this? Mm-hmm. I think this is, in some ways, since your mm-hmm. the whole point of your essay is mm-hmm. like, well, wait a minute, why not look at energe? And if we understood mm-hmm. that radically enough, then it would do the kind of work that Heidegger wants to have done in perhaps a different way. But
mm-hmm.
but mm-hmm. why? So as you're talking, it really occurs to me that, you know, it's the sentence in Being and Time where higher than actuality stands possibility, where Heidegger really sort of reverses the whole, attempts to reverse the whole tradition of Western philosophy mm-hmm. with a sentence. And it's sort of under the idea that we have to retain this notion of possibility
mm-hmm.
as holding the notion of actuality open,
mm-hmm.
right, that would, in some ways, explain the resistance to going to energeia and privileging energeia for Heidegger, to privilege energeia right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
I still think that, and so it would make a good sense to say, okay, well, wait a minute, what about kinesis? Maybe there is a dimension of dunamis there that is not caught up in the economy of dunamis and energeia that always ends up privileging energeia over dunamis.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound feasible? I mean, I kind of got it caught up in some of your own answer. But.
I'm not sure I understand exactly what you're suggesting. I mean, clearly Heidegger's project another way of formulating his projects to say that obviously it's an attempt to inverse the priority of energe and dunamis in Aristotle,
mm-hmm.
making dunamis prior rather
mm-hmm.
than energeia. And so why does he do that? Well, I think, again, what he seems to be operating with, or I think clearly is operating with, opposition or dichotomy, alternative between a conception of being as presence,
mm-hmm.
as being at hand, and a conception of and a dynamic conception of being,
right,
which would privilege dunamis and privilege motion, mm-hmm, as what truly characterizes human being and being more generally. And I think what happens as I read these seminars, this is what I'm trying to argue and trying to show, I think that operating with that kind of dichotomy, the problem is that energeia doesn't fit,
right,
that. Because energeia is neither static presence, mm-hmm, because energeia is activity in Aristotle. It's thinking, it's living, it's,
right,
feeling pleasure. But energeia is, according to Aristotle, also not kinesis. It's not motion, mm-hmm, because it's its own end, because it's not on the way to anything outside of itself, and therefore also is not characterized by dunamis.
Right.
So it doesn't really fit either of those conceptions of being that Heidegger is working with, both the one he attributes to the tradition and the one that he is himself trying to recover
right,
against the tradition,
right,
in reading Aristotle in the way he does. And that's why he ends up, as I tried to show in the paper, that's why he ends up with this conception of energeia that in a sense splits it. It's a kind of a into two moments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he for him this distinction, as I mentioned in the paper,
right,
between energeia and entelecheia is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one, as I said in the paper, it's one constant in all of his seminars, all of his courses, is that distinction,
mm-hmm,
which he really emphasized between energeia and entelecheia.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason he emphasizes that distinction is that the entelecheia fits the conception of being as presence, right? Entelecheia,
right,
if you understand it literally as having in the end, possessing the end,
yeah,
being at an end, or being completed, being perfected,
mm-hmm,
it fits the notion of being a static presence.
Right.
And energeia, then, could be the word to refer to the motion or process.
Mm-hmm.
So he ends up, in a way, taking the Aristotelian concept of energeia / entelecheia and
right,
splitting it up
right,
into a moment that fits the conception of being as presence that Heidegger's working against.
That would be entelecheia.
Entelecheia, and then the moment that emphasizes motion, process,
right,
and therefore also, and is also tied to dunamis,
right,
energeia of dunamis, and the definition of motion, which is what Heidegger himself wants to privilege in his own reading of Aristotle against the tradition.
Right.
And so what I'm essentially arguing is that split,
right,
of energeia into these two different moments misses, in my view, what is unique to
right,
energeia, what sets it apart from both kinesis and a conception of being as presence.
Right. Let's hear a little bit more about that, because I think this is I want to hear a more, I mean, you did a great job at that in the paper of articulating a conception of energeia that really would be, I think, true to Aristotle's own thinking, and you brought up the notion of particularly of God as thought thinking itself, and
mm-hmm,
and the energeia that God is, to try to do that. I'd like you to say a little bit about your conception of energeia and why you think we fail to understand it, where particularly when we see it as bound up with dunamis in the way in which it may be in the, you know, sort of natural world.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so because then if once we have that, then I think, you know, you and I can continue a discussion we started, I thought,
yes,
in the talk, which, and it's an ongoing one, because I mean your critique of my book, which I really do appreciate, is to really press me to think a little bit more about what,
mm-hmm,
energeia, particularly with respect to God, is. And in fact, I want to say this publicly, which is that, you know, your pushing me on some of those issues really caused me to go back and look back at Metaphysics 12 and to try to develop a conception, mm-hmm, of energeia that's more true to the Aristotelian notion along the lines of, I think, of what you're arguing, although I still come back, even at the end, to try to retain something of dunamis, but not in the standard way. So then when you asked me this morning, sort of, mm-hmm, what would dunamis mean, I'd like to go back to that conversation by the end of this. But
right,
talk,
mm-hmm,
a little,
mm-hmm,
bit about your understanding of energeia,
yes,
and Aristotle.
Yes. Well, let me first say that what I see myself as doing in that final part of the paper and all the work I've done up to now on this is responding to a challenge, I find in Aristotle,
yeah.
and it is a challenge for me too.
Right.
And that is the challenge of thinking activity, something that would be an activity,
right.
that wouldn't be motion, that right. wouldn't involve dunamis, that wouldn't involve potential.
Okay.
I think that's a real challenge.
But see, okay, and let's pause there for a second, because right. I would say, okay. yes, thinking an activity that's not motion,
mm-hmm.
but I wouldn't want to too quickly eclipse or identify kinesis and dunamis. I mean, I think it is. They belong together in one sense in Aristotle, but I just want to open up the possibility that there might be room for another notion of dunamis that is not that's not motion,
and that
I think we're closer to one another on this. I would like to call it dunamis. I think you want to just recognize difference, self differentiation.
Yes.
Within an ergeia itself.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately I would just like to call that that differentiation dunamis, you know, recognizing that Aristotle wouldn't want to say that.
Right, right. You know? No, I can see that. Though I will do you the favor of giving you your best text in support uh-huh. of your position,
right.
Which is a text that I actually referred to in a note to my paper, so it's not something I presented this morning.
So you're hearing it here on the Digital Dialogue.
Yes, here it is. Here's my gift to you. There is this extraordinary passage in which I'm sure you know in Book 12 of the Metaphysics, where Aristotle does characterize the unmoved mover as having infinite dunamis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a very strange, has puzzled, for obvious reasons,
right.
has puzzled many, many readers
right.
as to, wait,
it's no dunamis.
And how is no dunamis
right.
infinite dunamis?
Exactly.
Now, obviously, many different ways you can read that, obviously, but part of the idea is that the unmoved mover has infinite powers,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's not power
right.
of the unmover is not limited in any way.
And dunamis,
but
the
use
of
the word dunamis there is still significant. And again, in one could use that text in support of your suggestion to argue that there is a different conception of dunamis here. I mean, obviously, it can't be dunamis there. Can't if it is attributed to the unmoved mover, can't mean the dunamis of matter. Can't mean the dunamis
right, and
of
it can't be incompleteness
right.
in that sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, and that's something I've been thinking of myself. I mean, I think that there might be a sense in which, if properly understood, energeia in its purest form, i.e. in the unmoved mover, could also be seen as a kind of dunamis.
Mm-hmm.
Though, again, we would have to be very careful as to how
right.
we characterize that dunamis. Because, again, it would have to be it would have to be a dunamis that's not incomplete, a dunamis
right.
that is not actualized by something outside of it.
Right.
A dunamis that is its own actuality, to put it that way,
right.
and
right.
so what does that mean,
right.
And how do we conceive of that? Now, maybe one way to do this is to say that if it's precisely the incompleteness of motion,
mm-hmm.
which Aristotle emphasizes in his definition of motion, it's precisely the incompleteness of motion that explains the fact that in motion, energeia and dunamis are distinct.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could argue that it's therefore precisely the completeness that characterizes the unmoved mover
mm-hmm.
that allows energeia and dunamis there to be identified.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's, I don't know if that's the way you're
well,
thinking, but that maybe
yeah.
that's the way, one way to go with that.
I think it may be, but I'd actually like to hear you press a little bit more your reading that does away with dunamis. That says, okay,
yeah.
here's a conception of energeia that doesn't have dunamis, it's not motion, and yet it's also not. And I think this is my ultimate word, and here I think I am, you know, drawing in some ways on the Heideggerian idea of higher than actuality is possibility.
Mm-hmm.
That if how does this concept, your conception of an energeia as you articulated today,
mm-hmm.
which I found very compelling, not fall back into not a metaphysics of presence, but at least a kind of totalizing way of thinking in which, okay, there ultimately priority has to be given to this thing called energeia, and if you want to entertain any kind of difference in that, then it's I guess my worry is that and this is bound up in a kind of foundational process project. Mm-hmm. And I don't see you, the way you talk about energe as doing that, but I worry that if we say, okay, let's really give the privilege to energe properly understood, yeah, don't we fall into a trap of saying, well, we had to do that because we're worried about some of the things Aristotle himself is worried about the destruction of the universe and about the decay, the possibility of decay, mm, and all of that, and all of that. So, I mean, I really like what you argued about living a full life,
yeah,
the notion of life.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to hear that. I want to hear that that vision again of energeia.
Well, an issue of foundationalism, yeah, or totalizing philosophy, it depends on what one means by that, because the reason why this talk in the Heidegger seminars of absolute motion is significant, I really draw that out, is because one could argue that Heidegger's own view is foundationalist. I mean, he, mm-hmm, is privileging a particular, in this case, motion, a particular, yeah, understanding of motion,
right,
as the fundamental ontological concept from which everything else is derived.
Right.
So the question here is simply, what I'm doing as Heidegger is saying, no, that's not, it's not motion, it's not kinesis, that, right, should be the foundation here. Who wants to use that word? It's energeia.
But you don't want to play that foundational game, though, or do you?
Well, it depends. I mean, it seems to me that one... It seems to me that one has to privilege something here. I mean, that one has to argue that whether it is dunamis and kinesis that one privileges, or whether one privileges energeia. In other words, to go back to chapter 8 of Book Fate of the Metaphysics, you, mm-hmm, know, you either have to come down on Aristotle's side that energeia is prior to dunamis, mm-hmm, or come down on the opposite side that dunamis is prior to energeia.
I guess that's one of the things I resist, in the sense that, mm, I mean, here I think Heidegger's vocabulary of equiprimordiality is helpful.
Mm.
And that's why I would like to hear you came up with this great idea of syncretic temporality, is, yeah, that what you called it?
Yeah.
And so differentiating that conception of time, your conception of time, from ecstatic temporality in Heidegger, yeah, I think will help me understand a little bit more about how you want to privilege energeia, but I don't see what you're doing is in this foundational project of, you know, the purpose of it is not to, you know, find the, you know, in the Cartesian sense, find the one point that upon
that's not true of what Aristotle's doing either.
Right.
It's a question. Maybe this goes to the second part of your earlier question. Is the privileging of energeia here a way of, because this is all the other aspect of Heidegger's argument, is this a way of effacing, masking human temporality and human finitude? Mm-hmm. I mean, because this is ultimately, you know, the issue, right? That, mm-hmm, to have this kind of so-called ontotheology that privileges a conception of being as eternal and unchanging and so on, that is to, in some way, ontologically speaking, to render derivative or subordinate the kind of being that characterizes human,
mm-hmm,
human being,
right?
And I guess what I'm trying to show in the paper is that I don't see that as taking place in Aristotle, because what he's conceiving of and what he's thinking of when he thinks of the energeia, the unmoved mover, is the energeia that characterizes human life itself,
right,
and the temporality that characterizes, mm-hmm, human life itself. And that's why, again, I emphasize this notion of the aeon, because, mm-hmm, as Aristotle himself points out, that notion of the aeon is derived from, was originally used by the ancients,
right,
to describe a human lifespan.
Right.
And Aristotle says, you know, this is a brilliant word that just applies perfectly to, mm-hmm, to the unmoved mover.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an extraordinary claim, mm-hmm, and so there I'm wanting to argue that the privileging of the unmoved mover and pure energeia is for Aristotle not something that eclipses human human being and human temporality, but rather something that first enables us to truly understand human being and human temporality as being like that.
Sure.
So, but I think, and this is the interesting thing for me, philosophically speaking, I think it does result in a very different conception of human being and human temporality, very different from the Heideggerian conception.
Okay, so how?
Well, partly because I think that the emphasis on finitude
in Heidegger
mm-hmm. is not there.
Mm-hmm.
The emphasis is instead, and this seems clear to me, the emphasis instead is on the what I call the sort of the qualitatively eternal character of human existence. This for me is the what's so fascinating about the notion of energeia, which I try to emphasize at the end of the paper. And again, maybe this claim that I make sounds preposterous, but I do think it's true. That what's so striking about the notion of energeia for me is that if we take seriously what Aristotle's saying, an energeia that lasts 1 second is as good and as perfect as one that lasts for eternity.
Mm-hmm.
That its very character is such, because it's not stretched out in time. Its very character is such that it is perfect and complete at every moment, as Aristotle says.
Right.
And so that
and duration suggests, is not part of its. It's not part of its essential character.
Not part of its essential character. And so, if we apply that conception of energeia to human life, what that suggests is that if human life certainly is finite in the sense that Aristotle well knows that we die and so on, for him that finitude is not essential to the character of our being as energeia.
Mm.
And so that would be a huge difference. I mean, that would be a significant difference between Aristotle and Heidegger.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm arguing in defense of Aristotle, where everyone comes down to this in the end, in defense of Aristotle, that's not to reduce human life to some kind of static, eternal, unchanging presence, because that's not what the notion of energeia suggests.
I mean, is there a way that it can be translated? I mean, because you did a lot of work about the now and properly understanding the now in Aristotle. I mean, is there a way in which that could be cashed out in terms of sort of affirmation of every moment of a life and recognizing, obviously, that life has a certain kind of duration, but that what Aristotle's conception of energeia as, or God's energeia, is the reminder that it belongs to us too, and that us humans too, and that means that in a certain sense, the way in which we are in the now all the time is. Can be determinative of a life properly if it's properly understood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because I could see how that could cash out. I mean, that was a kind of a possible way of responding, I think, to some of the worries that Larry Hattab had in the paper, which was in part about sort of what does this mean for us? How does it move the world? And in a certain way, the vision of the now that you articulate, which is. I mean, and here I do get a little, maybe I've just been too brainwashed by aesthetic temporality in Heidegger, where I see the present as saturated by future and past in a way that is not unlike how you described the now in Aristotle.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, When I speak in the paper of the now in Aristotle as having a dimension, even though it can't be measured, obviously, but it has a dimension, has a span. That I take that language from Heidegger.
Right.
And he himself says that in the Basic Problems of Phenomenology when he's interpreting Aristotle's account of time in the Physics. So yes, I mean there are parallels here.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot that's in common between the two ways of approaching time, and I want to emphasize that. But I also want to begin thinking about the differences. And to put it very crudely, I mean, it seems to me that on Heidegger's view, human existence is, by its very nature and its very being, always and radically incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what finitude means.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that on Aristotle's view, with the notion of energeia, human existence is at every moment complete. And that's the crucial difference. And so the question, of course, becomes, what is Aristotle? What I'm trying to do now is to try to understand what Aristotle means by with that idea that human life is at every moment complete.
Right.
That an activity like living or
right.
seeing or thinking is at every moment complete.
Right.
That as he says in that extraordinary passage or sentence I referred to in the paper, that the life never stops.
Mm-hmm.
Right. By which, again, doesn't mean that it doesn't end,
right.
but it means that its character is such that it doesn't, because it's not a movement towards
right.
an end, it's always complete, and therefore, in that sense, it never stops.
Right.
You can stop living, but your stopping living doesn't actually affect the fact that every moment prior to that
mm-hmm.
moment, you have been living and are living and all in a moment
right.
In the sense of completeness. So what I'm trying to do is understand, well, what does that mean, and what notion of temporality
right.
is involved in that Aristotelian view.
And
the project here ultimately is to, you know, what I'm trying to do here is first, having started out with the sense that Heidegger doesn't really come to terms with the notion of energeia in Aristotle,
mm-hmm,
by interpreting energeia and reducing energeia to motion.
Right.
Starting with that sense, you know, what I'm trying to do now is figure out, well, what exactly is energeia in Aristotle, and how do we make sense of this? How do we even think this? With ultimately the intention of going back to Heidegger,
mm-hmm,
and sort of reading Heidegger critically now,
mm-hmm,
to see if this conception of temporality in Aristotle is a genuine alternative to the conception of temporality in Heidegger, and if
mm-hmm.
so, in what sense?
Well, I do like, I mean, you introduced the term of synectic temporality, and then you apologize
yeah.
for it. I like that term, because I think it really does get at this notion of continuity, and it gets at this notion of a temporality that would distinguish itself, as you eloquently have done here, from Heideggerian ecstatic temporality.
Yeah.
Just a couple of quick little things. One is that I, with regard to entelecheia,
mm-hmm,
in John Woodbridge has this vision, Aristotle's Vision of Nature book, which is a thin book that Charles Kahn wrote some notes to. It was one of his students, Charles was,
mm-hmm,
and in there he calls into question the etymology of entelecheia as having anything to do with echein, as having anything
mm-hmm.
to do with holding,
right.
and instead just says it's the abstract noun for enteles, which means complete. I think that could certainly fit
mm-hmm.
in fine with
yes.
your
mm-hmm.
with your account, but it could be also a way of criticizing, if it's true, if Kahn is right about that, then it could be a way of criticizing, I think, the Heideggerian kind of tendency to think of this as rooted in the etymologically rooted in the idea of echein, of holding.
Though interestingly, one part of the paper, precisely in this issue of the etymology of entelecheia,
uh-huh,
one part of the paper I left out because I was worried about the time.
Right.
About time.
Oh, there you go.
Time is always the worry.
Exactly.
Is a fascinating part in one of the seminars where Heidegger appeals to this book by Teichmuller,
uh-huh,
written in 1873.
Uh-huh.
I think that the title of the book is just Aristotelische Untersuchungen or something.
Uh-huh.
It's a general
right.
collection of studies on Aristotle, in which Teichmuller argues, and Heidegger emphatically embraces this argument and makes it his own. Teichmuller argues that entelecheia actually, in its original form, was endelecheia,
uh-huh,
with a delta instead of a tau,
yeah,
and therefore was derived from endelekos,
uh-huh,
which actually dolikos,
uh-huh,
which means duration, lasting,
nice,
something that lasts, something that persists. Fort Dauern is,
mm-hmm,
is Heidegger's translation,
mm-hmm,
and the reason why Heidegger likes the etymology is that makes that enables him to read entelecheia as presence, you know, as this continuing presence, as something that endures, that perdures, that remains the constant, that remains the same.
Right.
So he's there actually, and then what he argues there is that what Aristotle did was simply change the D to a T so that he could connect the notion of entelecheia to telos.
Yeah, right.
But that the original meaning of entelecheia or entelecheia was one of remaining constant,
right,
remaining the same,
right,
enduring.
Wow.
So it's a...
yeah. Well, I mean, so this brings actually to... Because I wanted to sort of just bring it back around to this issue where I think my work and your work come in close contact. And so in this book on Aristotle and the Nature of Truth that I just got finished, and I'd love to have you... you know, take a look at it and give some response to it, because I'll be interested to see what you say about it. But one of the things that I try to do in that book is to argue, sort of drawing on Heideggerian phenomenology and this tradition of American naturalism, to really recognize Aristotle as a phenomenological naturalist, and therefore take seriously that thinking and that the activity of thinking and the activity of energeia is a natural activity. It is part of all of nature is bound up in that, is engaged in this kind of activity in a certain kind of way. And what I tried to argue was that Aristotle's attempt to say things truly, to articulate the truth of things,
mm-hmm,
is actually, in this attempt, certain things get shown about how things are. So Aristotle's trust in language, that language can get at the nature of things, even if not completely and adequately, is something that is sort of, I think, resonates with what you're saying about the positive, about the completeness of life, about the emphasis not on inadequacy, but the all the ways in which human life is adequate to the world in which we live, the ways in which we can see things and encounter them in different kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to articulate what I call a logomenology in Aristotle, which is this attention to the way things are said as access into the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I was asking this question of you about the role of legain in the sensus communis section of the De Anima of De Anima, chapter 3, book 3, chapter 2, I think, where Aristotle, and I have a whole thing on this in the book, where Aristotle has to give an account of how we can at the same time have a perception of two different qualities of something, it being sweet and white at the same time. And the suggestion, and this comes from Heidegger, is that that the person judging, discerning that, is does it through a kind of legging, through a kind of logos. And so then I sort of try to play this out in book 12 of the Metaphysics, where I try to suggest that that Aristotle's attempt to articulate the being at work of God when he says those words, noesis, noeseos, noesis, and the very structure of that formulation shows something about the nature of that activity, namely the nature of energeia. And that's where I was trying to get, that's where I'm trying to retrieve a notion of dunamis in the very being of energeia that is not the dunamis of motion, and it's not the dunamis of, it's the dunamis of differentiation that is that is wholly complete. And even in just the way those three words hang together in the text sort of show it beautifully, because there's the noesis and the repetition of noesis, but in the middle is this genitive that sort of breaks it up in a certain kind of way, and can be understood objectively and subjectively, so that there is no subject and object in that activity. So I think that maybe ultimately reconcilable with what you're trying to articulate about energeia here, and might help as your points have helped me try to really rethink what energeia might mean. I mean, if we take it seriously, which I've resisted for so long because I can't. It's just so hard to get my mind around it. It reminds me of the first paper I gave at the APS, where your first question to me at the APS was exactly this: but aren't you understanding energeia in this totalizing way, and that's not the way it should be understood.
Yes, which is, you know, as I've already suggested, was also my questioning myself.
Yeah.
Because it's when I quote the comment in the paper today that's to be found in Jonathan Beer's recent book on Book Feta,
uh-huh.
where he says that energeia is a totally foreign concept to us.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely correct.
Right.
And that's startling. I mean,
yeah.
there is, I really don't think, and this is why I'm drawn to the notion of energeia in Aristotle. I don't think that in the tradition, in the philosophical tradition that has come down to us ultimately from Aristotle, I don't think we have the means of thinking what energeia means.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Heidegger himself actually points this out in the course of medieval ontology, where towards the very end he points out that this notion of energeia is completely lost in medieval ontology,
mm-hmm.
And completely eclipsed.
But do you
in
think
medieval ontology? So there's something there in Aristotle,
mm-hmm.
that's absolutely central to his thought. Using the terms that have come down to us in the subsequent philosophical tradition really can't make sense of. I mean, the very problem of translation,
right.
Which is also something that Jonathan Beer raises in the book, as he suggests, and I think again this is completely correct. The fact that we in English translations of Aristotle, we have to sometimes translate energeia as activity and sometimes translate it as actuality. It's really scandalous.
Mm-hmm.
Because that suggests that there's a fundamental ambiguity,
right.
in Aristotle's fundamental ontological concept that Aristotle himself never comments on or points to.
Right.
And so either we assume that Aristotle was just, you know, terribly confused and using the same word to talk about two totally different
right.
things, or there's something in that word that neither our translation activity or our
right.
translation actuality
right.
can capture.
Well,
and
I think it happens the other way around, too. And well, mm-hmm. first of all, I mean, you could do things with entelecheia and energeia, because that is a distinction Aristotle makes. I think you're right to criticize the way Heidegger wants to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But same with morphe and eidos, for example, which Heidegger does a good job of,
mm-hmm.
of
mm-hmm.
reminding us that, oh, wait a minute, he uses two different words.
Right.
Here, you know, a lot of translators just want to say, well, form, you know, that's what
mm-hmm.
it is, it's form.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, you know, maybe they'll say shape every so often for morphe. But,
yeah.
I mean, but trying
mm-hmm.
to unpack, as I've tried to do in some essays, the connotations of what morphe and why morphe here and eidos here and how eidos gestures to a certain kind of, and because of its ambiguity, meaning species as well as the
mm-hmm.
look of something can do different kinds of interesting philosophical work than morphe, which is much more rooted in the in embodiment and,
mm-hmm.
and closer to the idea of shape. So, I mean, there's in terms of translation and in terms of going to your point about our ability to get ourselves into the place where we might even be able to grasp
mm-hmm.
something of what Aristotle's trying to say,
yes.
is an important one. And I tend to think, though, that our inability to deal with energeia may have something, or maybe I'm speaking of myself, may have something to do with my, or the human desire to consolidate things into a system, to
mm-hmm.
get an equivocal sense of something, to find an absolute prior or a foundational something,
mm-hmm.
and that's the thing. So if I can get myself outside of that project or that concern. And thinking about Aristotle as appealing to this, the idea of energeia, to just underwrite his system and to give it, you know,
mm-hmm.
permanence and to not let everything, you know, fall into destruction. If I can get outside of that way of thinking about it,
mm-hmm.
I think I have a better chance at approaching it in a way that would be more fruitful. And I've tried to do that in this book, and
mm-hmm.
in great part because of your encouragement to say, hey, take this seriously. So
mm-hmm.
I want to say how much I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I want to say how
and
much...
It,
yeah,
well,
go ahead,
I'll
finish.
Just add a note to
yeah,
what you just said, because an issue, one Heideggerian thesis that one finds in a number of courses, but also in these seminars that I talked about this morning, is that behind the Greek conception of being is fear or anxiety, right, of the kind that you're referring to, right? This fear or anxiety that, you know, that motion will stop, that the world will be destroyed.
Right.
And I actually think that the evidence for that is, maybe I won't go as far as say it's non-existent, but but I don't see that in Aristotle.
Uh-huh.
I don't see that concern at all. There is a passage that Heidegger often cites where Aristotle says, well, the ancients were afraid that the skies would stop moving.
Right.
But he doesn't refer to that as his own fear.
No.
This is a fear that they had, you know, back then. But I don't see that as affirming his own fear. So I don't really see in Aristotle that kind of anxiety that Heidegger speaks of finding something that's unchanging or permanent as a way of countering the impermanency and finitude and of life. I don't see that,
right.
and so I don't see that as motivating the discussion of an appeal to energeia.
Well,
I think what I see again in that is an ability to perceive, even in a finite, ephemeral life, the ability to perceive the eternal, to perceive what is perfect or good, even in what's fleeting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I find that in Aristotle more than I find this attempt to this fear of what is fleeting,
right,
and therefore this desire to look for something permanent.
Mm-hmm. No, I can see. I mean, that's helpful because I think, I mean, your own reaction to my first book, which really was guided by that vision that, you know, this is Aristotle at odds with himself in the sense that he's a good enough phenomenologist to say he's got to do justice to phenomena, but he also has this desire for, you know, system and stuff. So, I think I'm moving to a different place with Aristotle, more along the lines of what you're suggesting, and I would consider it Aristotle's naturalism, this recognition that we belong to the universe, we humans belong to the universe, and therefore, you know, have access to what your this dimension of eternity properly understood, not as everlastingness, right? Really can help us make sense of our own lives just by holding out the possibility of being able to feel the good or the beautiful, right? And I say feel because it's not necessarily a conceptual grasp,
In fact,
it's probably not a conceptual grasp.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I really appreciate, Frank, you coming on to the Digital Dialogue and the opportunity to talk to you.
It's been a pleasure.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to the Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of the Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for the Digital Dialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue.